Welcome to Politics and Tactics, brought to you by Fire Engineering. We have a great show. We're going to be talking about some tactics on closing the door and some critical things with PJ Norwood and two guests. But first, everybody knows this is the show where you can ask the hard questions and sometimes get the right answers. And we got the best possible guest for what's going on in America today. No other than the editor-in-chief, Bobby Hall. And we're going to be talking about his last op-ed and his op-ed, his editorial that's coming out on vaccine mandates. There's nothing that's in the fire service right now that's affecting our members across the board than vaccine mandates. And I just want to welcome Bobby Halton to his own show. And I'll let him start this off because he'll do it in a way that's eloquent and will capture the what's going on in the American fire service in a very cogent way. Chief Halton.
Well, thank you, Frank, and pleasure to be here. This is going to be political, so I'll try to be to the point and as succinct as I can. So we're the canary in the coal mine right now. Public safety workers, nurses, obviously we're the first people, federal workers, we're the first people who the Biden administration's mandate via OSHA to have any organization over 100 employees vaccinated it has affected. And there's a million nuances to this particular situation. Currently in the American Fire Service, we've got multiple organizations, departments that have already enacted their deadlines. Portland, Oregon, where now firefighters have been granted exemptions. However, they're not allowed to eat or drink while they're on duty. Basically, they have to be masked at all times. They can't sleep in quarters with the others. They can't, actually interface with the crews on duty. Really draconian elements to what's happening there. Seattle, last month, we published a letter from Jason Allen, who is a Seattle firefighter. He has been terminated by the Seattle Fire Department, as well as dozens of other firefighters and law enforcement officers in that particular community. We've had umpteen nurses and doctors contact us who've lost their positions in various cities across the country because they have missed the deadline, as well as a few members of the United States military who are leaving on administrative leave on the enlisted ranks and via other processes and in other ranks because they're going to refuse to comply with the mandate. So it becomes a wickedly complex problem. And the vaccines are out there. The effectiveness of them is yet to be determined because like everything else in science, it continues to evolve as we get more data, as more people are vaccinated and we'll have better data on how effective it is or isn't. I went to two funerals this week. Both were fully vaccinated people who contracted COVID and unfortunately lost their lives. Both were younger than me, which was interesting. So we've got very, very interesting issues. The fundamental premise for me as the editor-in-chief of Fire Engineering is personal choice and liberty. If this vaccine was a vaccine of the past where you had 90% immunity or 95%, and it was something that was within the human species that we can control, I'd be 100% say, we ought to do it. But the problem is that this is carried by mammals. It's a COVID virus and it changes constantly. Now we've got the Delta Plus variant that's coming out and we'll have another and another. Vaccines, there was a Maryland statistic the other day that 40% of the deaths in Maryland were fully vaccinated people. So we're getting data like that. So it becomes an interesting problem. The question of herd immunity. I read a piece from a Harvard professor today about herd immunity and how that was always nature's way of combating these trends. So I think it's way too early to be saying that we need to do mandatory vaccines for any age group or any profession. The second point that I make as an editorialist, and this is just my opinion, personal opinion, I'm the editor in chief and I get to write my personal opinion every month, is that if someone is not sick, whether they're vaccinated or unvaccinated, they're no threat to anyone. If someone who is vaccinated contracts COVID, they're a danger to others because they're sick. If someone is unvaccinated and contracts COVID, they're a danger because they're sick. If you're sick, you should stay home. You should quarantine. We've always done that, whether it was influenza, the chicken pox. We've quarantined for all kinds of different contagious diseases. So I don't have any problem with that. I don't have any problem if an organization wants to test everybody every day, but you should test the vaccinated and the unvaccinated if you're that worried about it. I just think that the illusion of control is overwhelming people. In other words, they believe that you control every single aspect of your life, and that's just not true. Living involves a certain element of risk. And yes, this is a horribly terrible disease. One of the folks whose funeral I attended was a dear friend, a neighbor, great guy. He was a surgeon. His name was Jim Crow. Wonderful fella, character, just bigger than life kind of character. I think he was a Cree Indian. Just an amazing fellow. Great, great guy. Anyway, so I get the pain and suffering. I get that 67 firefighters, IAFF firefighters, have lost their lives. We're not disrespecting any of those people by saying that people have legitimate concerns, religious, medical, personal, about taking this particular vaccine. And that needs to be respected. This is America, freedom of choice, freedom of religion, freedom of expression, freedom of association. And so I believe that I stand with all of those that believe in choice. And I think that the government is going to be found to have overreached in this case. Now, many people will point, as I pointed out in my editorial, to the 2006 decision where the Supreme Court decided that a town in Massachusetts could demand the smallpox vaccine. This is not smallpox. The fatality level for COVID is much lower than smallpox. And it's much, much more contagious. More people can get it. And I'm not discounting what a horrible, horrible disease can be. But what I am saying is that it's very easily transmitted. Vaccinated people seem to be able to get it just as easily as unvaccinated people. So I have a disagreement with the president and others who say that it's a pandemic of the unvaccinated. Maryland statistics alone disprove that. So I would ask people to step back and let cooler heads prevail, perhaps develop a better vaccine if that's at all possible. I mean, we've been battling the common cold now for, I don't know, 10,000, 20,000 years, whatever it is, 50,000 years. And we're no closer to curing that yet either. So it may be something that'll weaken with time. It may get worse with time. I don't know. But I do know that the men and women in the American Fire Service that were now taking away their careers, if they were sick at all, would not come to work. They put the safety and care of the community that they pledged their lives to first and foremost. So I can rest assured that vaccinated or unvaccinated, the American firefighters not coming to work if they don't feel well in the least bit. And they're gonna self-report the moment they don't feel well if they happen to be at work, and they're gonna go home. So I think we need to take a step back, take a deep breath and say, let's see how the vaccines play out with those who want to take it. Let's see how herd immunity goes. Let's see what the future may bring. You know, my good friend Pete Prochilo says that this vaccine will make fools of us all. And he's exactly right. There's no silver bullet out there. There's no easy answers. But one of the folks who are losing their job, or several, but one in particular that I received an email from at the FDNY, has 42 or 42 and a half years in. He survived the collapse of the tower. He's been a lieutenant for 25 years plus, and we're letting him go. He's served throughout the entire pandemic. He's one of the most elegantly trained and highly proficient firefighters in America. And we're going to take away his opportunity to leave on his own terms because of this mandate. And I think it's wrong-headed. I think it's with all of the best intentions. I'm not casting aspersions. I believe that the people who are behind these mandates in their hearts feel like they're doing exactly the right thing. I feel in my heart that we should slow down and see if we can't come to a better conclusion. The firefighters union for the folks in Portland is fighting hard. The FDNY is fighting hard. Governor DeSantis has said he's going to come out and help some of the firefighters in Florida who've lost their jobs and stand to lose their jobs. So we have people on all sides of the aisle on this. There are elegant doctors and professors from Harvard and all of the other great named schools and even just great doctors and epidemiologists who are saying, slow the roll. Let's hang on a second. Maybe not everybody needs to do this. And then there's others equally credentialed and equally respected who are saying, oh, no, we need to vaccinate everybody. I don't know what the answer is, but I certainly know that firing people is not the answer. And if you really want to get people's opposition, force them. And government is always at the point of a gun. And it should be the last resort, not the first resort. Ordering people to do something at the point of losing their livelihood should be the very last recourse. And you should be absolutely 100% certain that it is the only answer. And quite frankly, we don't know that yet. So I wrote the op-ed last month with Jason's letter. This month, in 3 days, 4 days, my op-ed comes out talking about this very issue to the National Fallen Firefighters, who asked folks to only come to the National Fallen Firefighters Memorial that were vaccinated. I thought that was the wrong thing to do. Now, if you had written a letter saying if you felt sick at all to not come, totally understand that. But just because someone's not vaccinated does not mean they're sick. And just because someone is vaccinated does not mean that they could not be sick and be a carrier. So, you know, to exclude people was purely political. And I think we need to avoid that. So that's what we're talking about here at Fire Engineering. We're talking with different locals. We're talking with Eddie Kelly. Eddie Kelly's been very open and transparent with me. He's been wonderful to work with. Eddie is pro vaccine, but not pro mandate. As I understand Eddie, he would rather people comply voluntarily, and he strongly encourages all the IAF members to do that. I hope I'm quoting Eddie correctly. Eddie can come on and state that more eloquently at any time. He knows that. Eddie and I are in constant communications with one another. I'm in constant communications with the folks at the iChiefs. They're wonderful people. They have stated their position on the mandates, that they're in favor of them, and I respect them. They took a vote as a group, and good for them. And I have nothing but the utmost respect for those people as well. You can disagree with people without casting aspersions or being mean or calling them names. They're wonderful, smart, bright, well-intentioned people. I just think that my opinion is that we should slow down, take a deep collective breath, and see how this runs its course. Maybe in 6 months or a year, we'll have greater clarity on how to move forward. But people with religious exemptions or medical exemptions should be honored. And I think if we're going to test everybody. Sorry for the political statement. Frank, if you have any questions, I'll stand for questions.
No, I do. And one of the things, you know, just like any issue, there's nuances and complexities that aren't fully understood until more data comes in. Matter of fact, one of the doctors on the FDA panel actually encouraged children to be vaccinated so they could get more data, because the data set just isn't there yet. It's a new virus. But there seems to be preliminary data that individuals that had COVID have as good, if not better, immunity, and that will be vetted out. And yet what we see these mandates doing is not really following even the science right now and painting with a very broad brush. If you look at court cases when it comes to mandates and things of that nature, there's always two words that usually will pop out. And is the solution narrowly tailored? And what I see with these mandates is they're not narrowly tailored by any means. And I'm hoping that as this works its way through the court system, and you know, I've gotten a lot of calls from people who read Fire Engineering magazine who are like, well, when's the Supreme Court going to rule on this? It's very rare for the Supreme Court on any issue to just jump in. It's not that type of organization. That's not how our government's set up. Essentially, this is going to have to work its way through the lower courts. And then once you see the Court of Appeals start ruling on these issues and actually creating precedents, and especially if you have Court of Appeals that differ in their interpretation of the law, that will increase the likelihood of the Supreme Court taking up review. What are your thoughts on that?
And well, two thoughts. You're exactly right that the data sets are constantly evolving. And this, you cited the Australians and the the Israelis, the Israeli study where natural immunity was found to be 26 or 25 or whatever times more than a vaccine immunity, which is you know, in that study, as I understand the reporting. Also, when you talk about a narrowly tailored mandate or rule, so it has to become law to the Supreme Court. The purpose of the Supreme Court was never to legislate morality. It's whether or not something's constitutional. In other words, does the government have the right to mandate a vaccine? Now, we go back to 1906, I believe, or 1908, the smallpox decision. Remember that decisions like that were made. We've had Supreme Court decisions overturned. Eugenics was upheld, the Kerry Buck decision, where the Supreme Court upheld that based on someone's mental status, they could be sterilized. And 70,000 some odd Americans were subsequently sterilized. That's where the vasectomy was perfected at an Indiana boys school where they had kids that they felt incorrigible. But you know, it got to be, there were schools of eugenics throughout America, throughout the world back in the 20s and 30s. And you know, you could be dyslexic, you could be autistic, and they were sterilizing people. So, because they didn't know, right? But you don't know what you didn't know. But that was a Supreme Court decision. It was 8-1. It was only one dissenting justice in the Kerry Buck decision. And she was sterilized against her will. So that was going on. And so just because, you know, nine people in long black robes make a decision, they're not infallible. No one on earth is infallible. And things change with new data and new understanding. And so to your point, it will get to the Supreme Court probably at some point. Maybe it'll be with the FDNY, maybe it will be with whomever. And we'll find out how the Supreme Court comes down on the constitutionality of it. I just think that there's a, you know, I always go back to Ben Franklin. I think he really kind of said it very well. He'd rather a hundred guilty men go free than one innocent man hang. When we're hanging innocent firefighters who've done no wrong and have not gotten anyone sick, have no potential to get anyone sick, they just do not want to be vaccinated. When we're taking away their livelihood and ending their careers, that's a pretty dramatic, pretty dramatic step to take, lacking a strong, compelling body of evidence that their current physical condition presents a hazard to the community, because no one, and I've laid this out for the last 9 months since this conversation began, has been able to tell me otherwise. If you're not sick and unvaccinated, you're no threat to anyone for COVID. If you don't have COVID, you're just another human being. And if we're going to create, you know, a caste system in the United States of vaccinated and unvaccinated, the filthy and the clean, be careful where that goes. That gets interesting. So clearly it's going to end up in the courts, but I think that the smart money right now would be everybody just to say, look, let's get more data. Let's think about this a little more deeply. You know, let's see where it goes. I don't see the harm in slowing down, but I see tremendous harm in potentially having 7,000, 8,000 New York City firefighters lose their jobs on Friday. I mean, and that's EMS workers and civilians, and that's just FDNY. Think about how this rolls across the country, you know, in states where they've created this mandate. It's terrifying, and it's not healthy. And I understand why people are upset, and I share their angst, and I want to see this. I want to see this resolved peacefully, and I want to see it resolved intelligently. And I think right now it's all emotional and it's all political, and it doesn't need to be this way.
There's another issue, and people need to realize that this affects the volunteer departments across the country too, because they want the volunteers to be vaccinated. And we know across the country, our volunteers, a lot of departments are in crisis with staffing, and this definitely doesn't help. But when we talk about, you know, you said hanging, but when we talk about termination, that's the equivalent of the death penalty in a labor situation. And while I've seen New York City's union president, Andy, I might mispronounce his last name, I think it's Ambrosia, really step up to the plate, I've been very disappointed at labor across the board. While I personally am pro-vaccine and I've been vaccinated, the fact of the matter is it shouldn't be compelled. And the unions across the country, I mean, even take something as simple as physical fitness. When heart attacks, I think cancer's there now, but heart attacks was the leading cause of firefighter deaths for you know, the last 50 years. The union stood and said, no, you can't mandate physical fitness training for incumbents. It's a mandatory subject of bargaining. You can do it for people coming in to mandate, but you can't just take somebody who's working, that 42-year veteran of New York City, and say, hey, tomorrow you have to pass this test that an 18-year-old's going to pass. That's not the way labor worked. And the fact that I see unions caving and just going along to get along makes no sense to me. I mean, unions every day in America defend people for drunk driving, beating their wives, beating their husbands. I mean, I've personally defended people who have done the most heinous crimes, not even just administrative actions, crimes, because I've had to invoke my inner John Adams, and it was about the process and due process and defending these people. But now we have people getting fired for a choice that are incumbents, and a lot of unions are sitting on their hands and they're not even fighting the fight. And that's what I have a problem reconciling. I don't agree with anybody driving drunk. I don't agree with strangling your girlfriend, but yet I've defended those people off the process, because as Americans, we're entitled to all due process. And what I see now in America is all of a sudden due process doesn't matter. And the unions that are supposed to be stamping up shoulder to shoulder in solidarity, the brother and sisterhood, are letting a lot of their brothers and sisters down. And same thing with our city council people, our volunteer associations and commissions. They should be standing with the volunteers to say, and I kind of like how Bobby Halton said it, was maybe we just need a pause. All these individuals were working during the pandemic. We thought it was going to be 5 to 8 years before they even had a vaccine. And now the data is not fully in. So let's work to understand the problem a little bit more before we start firing people. I mean, when the AIDS epidemic came up, it ended up we all started wearing gloves. Well, I mean, wearing a mask is much more reasonable than, and more narrowly tailored than, firing somebody. So, Bobby, can you weigh in on that?
Well, I'm not going to comment on the responsiveness of union leadership. I don't follow it closely enough, although I have had several folks tell me that they were disappointed. But you're always disappointed when people don't agree with you, which is fine. And people should voice that. And that's what elections are about. If you don't like the way that they run against them, or vote for the other guy. So, you know, that's where that's at. To your other points, I think that you're exactly right. And I love the John Adams defending the British soldiers at the shooting in Boston. That was a great, 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 great one there. I like that one. I've been thinking of that the whole time too, right? In other words, you've got to, everyone's entitled to a defense, and protecting one's job is the job of our locals, but it's also the job of every other concerned American should be concerned about every other American's freedom, liberties, and their pursuit of happiness. That's our basic tenets, right? That we got each other's sixes. And I think that my dad used to have a great quote. He used to say, there always seems to be enough time to do something over, but there never seems to be enough time to do something right. So, you know, why don't we just, and it's going to be an interesting deal too, because remember, we've got red states, blue states. So the red states are not doing these mandates. Now, if Mr. Biden's national mandate starts to override state law, that's going to get really, really interesting. So then you've got a states' rights, federal rights deal, and I have no idea where that's going to, how that's going to wash, you know, and nor do I think that that's a smart move. I just think that at this point in time, Frank, people need to, one of the things in Chicago, another city that's poised to lose several hundred members, they're calling it hold the line, right? In other words, stand together. I remember the strikes in the 70s with the FDNY and things of that nature. So solidarity is part of it. You know, people are looking at that. I just think that this is the British have a term for it. They call it wickedly complex problems. This is a wickedly complex problem. There's no easy answer. But the worst thing you can do in any situation is to punish the innocent and to hurt the innocent. And these firefighters and police officers and nurses and doctors who are being terminated have done no wrong. They've hurt no one. Not getting vaccinated hurts no one. It doesn't mean you're killing anyone with your COVID. That's a horribly untrue statement. In other words, if you're not sick, you're not hurting anybody. Now, if you're sick and you're intentionally going out trying to make other people sick, you're a monster. I don't think those people are in our ranks. I'm sure of it. I know they're not. So, you know, I hate to burn up so much of Dustin and Nick's time. I know they want to talk about close the door before you snooze. Critically important deal. I appreciate your time, Frank, for, you know, this is politics and tactics. There's no way to avoid this gigantic political bomb that's been thrown into the fire service. My heart breaks every day for these firefighters that I'm in touch with constantly, all day long, who are reaching out, you know, how can you help us? Who can we talk to? I'm extremely proud of several people like Chief John Sinclair in Washington State, who's found ways to accommodate all of his people. So maybe people should reach out and take a look at Chief John Sinclair. We posted an article by him on fire engineering. He's a Washington State fire chief, and he's managed to find in Washington State, where Jay Inslee has mandated it, he's found a way to accommodate all of his folks. So maybe we could take a page from Chief Sinclair and slow our roll, as the kids would say. How do you like that, guys? Throw out to all my friends under 60. slow our roll and take a calmer look at it. And remember that the unvaccinated and the vaccinated who are healthy are healthy people. The vaccinated and the unvaccinated who are sick are sick. And it's just that simple. And there's no gray there. No one's going to argue with that. No one's going to say a perfectly healthy person without COVID is a threat to anybody. If you did, you're a complete idiot and no one should take you seriously on anything, because you're just lying. Because a healthy person who doesn't have COVID is not carrying anything. So any final thoughts, Frank?
Bobby, my final thought is, I was speaking to a great man who paraphrased Stalin the other day, and he said that when you kill one man, he's a martyr. When you kill 1,000, it's a statistic. So the lesson from that is, listen,
it's attributed to Stalin, but it was actually one of his lieutenants who said it. And you're right. If you kill one person, they're a martyr. If you kill thousands, it's a statistic. So it's nameless, faceless people. But Jason Allen is a real person, and he lost his job. And he's among thousands now who've lost their jobs and did nothing wrong. And that is a real crime. That's a real shame, a crime in the moral sense. That's crossing the Rubicon. And in my book, that's unforgivable. Now, if someone does something wrong, that's on them. But those people who are being let go have done no wrong. There's no compelling evidence that getting vaccinated benefits you in any way in terms of your protection. It's a 50-50 shot, according to what we're seeing out of Maryland. And natural immunity is being discounted, and many people's deeply held religious views. The Archbishop of the United States Navy has said being a Catholic qualifies for exemption.
And just to finish that point with Stalin, that's leadership. Take credit for what all the underlings say. But the fact of the matter is don't yell about your story. There are so many personal stories like Jason and what we see going on in FDNY. They have to get out and they have to tell their stories as individual and how it in, as individuals and how it impacts their lives. They have to start with emotion and then move to the standard in statistics and persistence in order to win the day. Because when we just yell at each other, nobody listens. So that's it for our politics portion of this. Now I'll be handing this over to PJ Norwood. And I want to thank Chief Halton on behalf of all fire engineering readers, whether you agree or disagree, you're always going to get an answer from Bobby and his unbiased and just heartfelt, well-researched opinion. And, you know, we appreciate it because that's what fire engineering is. It's the firefighter's journal with voices from all sides. So Bobby, thank you for being a great guest and, you know, very well said. PJ, would you like to introduce our other guest for the second half of our show?
Frank, you're going to have to take it. PJ just has an emergency, according to the chat.
Yep, I'll get it started quick, and then I'm going to just go off camera for a few minutes to check on that item, Chief. But thanks for that. So, Chief Frank, thanks for the opportunity, as always. I always enjoy listening to different perspectives, especially when we start looking at regional differences on things that are impacting us. And some things aren't so regional, impact every department and every agency in the fire service. So today being October, I felt it really important that we can touch on fire prevention. But I know if I just said we're going to discuss fire prevention education today, we would have no followers. And I'm going to get on a little soapbox here real quick before I jump and turn this over to Dustin and Nick. Fire prevention education is something that's very important to me, especially being one of the founding members like Nick, who's joining us today, with the Close Before You Doze and now the Public Safety and Education group with UL. Well, my fear and my concern is we consistently keep fire prevention education and our tactics on two different sides of the house. And very rarely do we realize where they actually come together. And when we start looking at one of our most tried and true and most life-saving measure in the fire ground of search and rescuing our civilians, it's directly tied to our fire prevention education messages. Dustin has been doing many of things as a captain in Cobb County with search. He's one of our FDIC hot instructors where his class focuses around fire behavior and search. And Nick has been very influential with UL's public education committee, specifically Close Before You Doze, as well as the firefighter rescue survey. These guys know the research. They know the data, and they know what's happening on our fire grounds when we talk about the research and live grabs being made. But how do we correlate that with our fire prevention education messaging? So for all those out there that are, you know, firefighters, officers, and they're preaching fire prevention, many of our messages are still stuck on the same messages that were given to me. I don't know if they were the same messages given to Chief Halton, but were given to me in elementary school with PubEd. And we have to make sure that our messaging is also reaching our firefighters. So if we're going to be telling our those in our community to shut the door before they sleep at night or close before you doze, we have to make sure that we're focusing our training on search. And we have to make sure that search training is specific to vent, enter, isolate, search. Because if we're telling those in our community that we're coming to get them, we better be trained and we better be prepared to go get them. So that's why I brought Dustin and Nick in today to discuss the search research, the fire rescue survey research, as well as the data that's being captured by UL and where we're actually finding our victims and how do we put that together so everybody is on the same page from public education to our search crews. So our public education, our tactics, our training is all kind of working together like it should. So I just kind of threw all that out there, threw that on the table. I'm going to go off camera, check on the issue that I have going on here at the Academy, and then hopefully I'll be back in about 10 minutes. But Dustin, Nick, thanks for joining us. And I'll just turn it over to you guys. I'll be back in a few.
All right, let's start off with Dustin. Weigh in on what PJ just said.
Yeah, so at least in our organization, we've been pushing the Close Before You Doze message for quite a while, kind of since its inception. And, you know, for us, it's important that we make that agreement with the citizen. For really the first time in the history of the fire service, we've told people when your building's on fire to stay where you're at, stay behind an isolated area. And, you know, we're seeing some of this data that proximity and elevation plays a huge, tremendous impact on survivability in the fire. Well, a closed door could really, you know, neutralize all of that and increase that survivability. So on our end, from the field or responding personnel, it's our responsibility to be aware that we're expecting to find these people in isolated rooms, that we shouldn't necessarily size up and judge the entire building from an Alpha side or a Charlie side. We have to look at room by room, compartment by compartment, and can we get in there and search? Is there the probability that somebody's isolated in there and searching? And we have to be able to kind of occupy as much space as possible as rapidly as possible if we're unaware of these isolated areas.
Very well said. And, you know, it goes back to, I know that we put an I in VES, but when I was taught VES in 92, it was always still about closing the door, where, you know, on the tactics side, where I think we had kind of a lapse was we thought the fire knew which way we entered. So if we were doing a conventional search and we vented the window and left the member at the door with the door open to check for deteriorating conditions, it was kind of like a self-fulfilling prophecy that if the line wasn't in place yet, the fire is going to be coming to your location. So in 2006, we started teaching across the country of, if you're on a conventional search and the door to the bedroom's open, or even if you open it, is to close it behind you. And then if you want to leave that member at the door with the door closed to assist with the camera while one member searches, or you want to split, however you want to search the room, when you vent the window, you're going to get that initial lift. You're going to get better visibility. It's going to facilitate a much quicker and clean search. And now you can leapfrog to the next room. And if the line's in place, you can chalk that room open to aid in ventilation. Nick, you want to weigh in on that?
Yeah. First of all, thank you, Frank, Chief Halton, and PJ for having us on here today. We really appreciate the platform to kind of help spread the cure and spread the message. I'm going to hit that. I'm going to backtrack just a second. So the being part of the UL-FSRI Public Safety Education Advisory Group, we kind of have three pillars when it comes to public education and then just safety for the public in general. Those three pillars are going to be having working smoke alarms, making sure you close before you doze, and then also having exit plans and practicing exit drills in your house as well. So as much as we talk about the message, and it's kind of the sexiest message that we have is closing before you doze, we also want to make sure that if people can get out of the house or apartment or whatever, that you get out. If you can't get out, that's when you make sure that you utilize one of the most important tools that we have that we take for granted as a door, and get yourself behind a door. So you close the door, you turn your lights on, you go to the window, make yourself seen and heard to the firefighters, because we have this unwritten contract with everybody. Where the contract more or less says is, hey, you know what? We'll pay for your mortgage. We'll pay for your car payment. We'll pay for your retirement, as long as you make sure that you uphold your end of the bargain, which is making sure that if we are having an emergency, you come there fully competent and prepared, whether that's an EMS run, if your department does EMS, or if it's a hazmat incident, or if it's a fire, or any type of tech rescue, whatever those incidents are, like, that's our oath that we took. And it's kind of that unwritten contract that we have with our civilians. So solid point when it comes to VES, VEIS, window-based search, whatever we're calling it in 2021, is the importance of making sure that you close that door. If water's on that fire and that heat release rate is being decreased and we're winning, well, we have a foot on the throat of that fire, then we can go ahead and open up those windows. And that's kind of where that coordination piece gets brought in. There's a lot of discussion over the past decade plus about the importance of coordination between attack and ventilation. And sometimes I feel like that redheaded stepchild is search. So where does search fit in to this discussion? And it's exactly what you were saying, Frank, is where if you are attack and you have an open bedroom door and a closed bedroom door, as you're making your way to the seat of the fire, maybe quick shut that bedroom door real quick. If you're doing your 360 on this building and there's an open door on the Charlie side, maybe do a little life fire layout call out real quick, see if anybody's in there, try to get as much information as you can in those 5-10 seconds, and then shut that door as you complete your 360. Same thing goes when you're doing that window-based search. You go in there, you're beelining it to that hallway, get a quick look around. If there's an open door across the hall that I can really quick shut, I shut that door. If there's somebody in that hallway, I'll bring them in that room. So I appreciate how our public education messaging, you know, there's a big Venn diagram, is overlapping with our operational strategies and tactics as well. So I appreciate how we can kind of connect all these dots for everybody.
With you guys, being on UL's panel, I got a quick question for you. Has anybody thought about the nightlight issue? Because I think closing the door is critically important, but especially in the inner cities and everything, well, any kid, they don't want their door to their bedroom closed. And what usually gets the kid to close their door is having a nightlight, but we don't see a lot of them in a lot of our urban centers. Has there been any talk about the nightlight component of this to try to get more kids to close their door?
I'll speak to this real briefly and then I'll pass it to Dustin. Being part of the PSEAG, the Public Safety Education Advisory Group for UL, a lot of our discussion is with the fire service, but a lot of it, and maybe at times the majority of this, is with parents, with kids when we're in schools, but like parent groups online, a lot of the hesitancy that people have about closing your door before you go to bed is, well, then my dog or cat can't get into my room. My dog or cat likes to wander in the middle of the night. I can't hear my kid if he cries out. My kid doesn't likes to have a light. So as you're saying, so we try to give alternative solutions to this because we know the importance of a door. As Dustin kind of alluded to, there's four things that affect the survivability of a space when there's a structure fire. That's the elevation in the space. That's your proximity to the fire. That's whether or not that area is isolated or smoke can communicate. So that's that shut door. And that is the duration that you're going to be in that space as well. And one of the most important things we can do, as we know, and we've known for a long time, is just closing that door. So we try to give people alternative solutions. So making sure that you have smoke alarms within each room, making sure that you have dog doors. So a lot of times we'll see dog doors on the exterior parts of houses, exterior doors of houses, but you can put those on your interior doors as well. And UL has started to study this in a couple of their burns as well. Having some type of monitor so you can hear your kid if it's 2 o'clock and he's got a bad dream or she has a bad dream or has to go to the bathroom or is cold or whatever, that they can just talk to you and you still hear them through those couple closed doors. So we try to have some of these workarounds because we feel that the importance of the closed doors is so foundational to our safety. And it's free. We all have doors on our windows and it's easy to do. It takes a second to do. So we try to make sure that we capture both sides of that. Chief, did you have something?
First of all, I love when Nick talks because saying things like, you agree to pay our mortgages and our car payments, I'm like, it's called your salary. But he puts it into like really concrete terms. I always love listening to Nick. The other thing is, Dustin, if I see you doing a reduced profile through a doggy door, I'm going to stop that training so fast. But that's some great suggestions, right, that people need to hear. Like if you've got opposition, when people have opposition, rather than just saying, no, you got to do it, well, you could put a doggy door on there. You could do, you know, and nowadays, you know, my kids are obviously you guys' age, but today my grandkids, my daughter-in-law has an app and she can not only hear the kids, she can see them when in the bedroom, just picks up her phone and they're the kids, you know, in their beds. And so the technology's there. And so a lot of those oppositions can be overcome. Obviously, in socioeconomically deprived folks, it could be a little tougher, maybe just a simple nightlight or something. But we give out fire, you know, smoke detectors. We could probably give out nightlights too, which is probably a smart idea, Frank. Maybe we could start to include some ideas like that. It's a really neat idea. So I like it. I think it's a wonderful campaign. And I'll tell you that, you know, my generation, we grew up with the doors open to hear the kids. That was the kind of the thing, right? And then as the kids got older, we had the doors closed because we didn't want to hear them. So that's part of being a parent. But I think that the survivability in today's fire environment, you know, we've been preaching to folks for years, but simply closing the door, you know, and all the studies we did, and I've been blessed to be with the UL advisory board since the beginning. You know, I was with the advisory board before we were UL. We were NIST. So you know, when we see the temperature differences and the toxicity differences just from having the door closed, it's night and day. It's just night and day. And you know, for the folks that can get to a fire escape or a first floor, if your door's closed, your possibility of surviving a residential home fire go up exponentially. So it's great messaging. I'm glad we got guys, and I was teasing Nick, but I'm glad we have someone like Nick and Dustin. Dustin, when you watch him teach, he's got this natural ability as an instructor. So I highly recommend you take his class. And when you listen to Nick, he talks in pictures. And so those are the kinds of guys we want teaching the public and being on these advisory boards. So where do you, how can we as firefighters and still a firefighter, still out there representing the septuagenarians on the line there, buddy. So, you know, how can we help get that message out? I know that there's a UL stuff. How can we get Close Before You Doze, help people get past their objections? What are some of the campaigns that we can get from UL, from you guys, some ideas for departments that we can start working on today?
Well, I think, you know, first to kind of talk about it for our organization, we really started with that elementary school level to start rolling that out. You know, the Close Before You Doze campaign, it seems like we've already talked about, the parents are more hesitant of that closed door concept really than the children are. You know, they see it as their ability to be grownups or big kids that they can sleep behind the closed door. It's really the parents that are concerned. So we start communicating with them about the importance of it. I think, you know, for us as firefighters, it's also to, you know, the studies are just validating of, you know, even if you are finding somebody in a hallway or an open door room, we can now base our tactics off the ability to bring them into a room, to close the door, take the window, and even make those conditions better, right? So we are now selling into the field level, to the guys that are on the ground, the importance of not only prior to the incident, but during the incident, what a closed door can do for us. And so that's important to roll that out as well. And once we have buy-in at all levels, you know, it's easy to talk to somebody in a 5 or 10 minute conversation about, hey, I understand your concerns, but look at all these things that benefit from it.
Yeah, you also has some pretty good resources for those listening that might not be aware. If you go to closeyourdoor.org, UL has set up this site. There's both a public site and a first responder site, and there's a bunch of resources there. So you can print out stuff to hand to teachers or to post up at elderly care facilities or wherever you go and do your public messaging for public education. So to get this information in front of people as well. And there's been a couple now kind of media tours that Steve Kerber from UL FSRI has done, where he's gone on a Today Show and Good Morning America and started to kind of preach the cure to everybody.
Has there been any data collected on how many victims have been saved behind a closed door?
Yeah, so if you look at firefighterrescuesurvey.com, we've been collecting this information for the past handful of years. I'm going to pull this up as we're talking. So we have a couple questions that are really specific to the three pillars. We can touch on two of these pillars in our questioning. The third pillar, making sure you have an escape plan. If they have an escape plan and they practice it and they got out, we don't get to capture those people, unfortunately. But for the people that are still inside the structure when we arrive, we do have some information there. So I'm scrolling through this document right now.
And we can just, you know, as Nick's finding the data or the numbers, you know, just from experience in our organization, we had 5 fire fatalities in a 6-week period with no working smoke detectors and all of them found behind open doors, right? These are all things that could have been at least given a better chance to the citizen, if not preventable. So, you know, in regards to that, it's not a lot to show somebody, you know, the downfalls or the negatives if we don't do this. However, finally, through, you know, Nick's work and the rest of the firefighter rescue survey, we can start trying to quantify the wins, you know, and talk about the positives of this Close Before You Doze, rather than just, hey, if you don't do it, death is a possibility.
So I ended up finding those numbers. So for the simple question, it's just a yes, no question. Was the victim found behind a closed door / isolated from the fire? And when we're comparing this to survival rate, when they were found behind a closed door, the survival rate is 86%. And when they were not found behind a closed door, the survival rate is 62%. So just to make sure that we have defined all these terms and we steelman this argument or this topic, a rescue is anytime we remove somebody from a building. a save is when they survived, as of last known data, are they still alive or not? And then to take that one step further, if we're going to look at, were they found behind a closed door with a smoking, with a working smoke alarm, survival rate is 93%, as opposed to when there is no, when they're not behind a closed door and there's no working smoke alarms, survival rate was 56%. So almost 40 percentage points higher thus far. And again, anytime we talk about this data, I want to make sure that I clarify that this isn't capturing every rescue that's out there. We're only capturing some unknown percentage of these rescues. And this information, there's a lot of other variables to go into play. So just don't take this data set as factual at this point in time. This is just the data that we've collected. So the most accurate data that we have shows that having a closed door versus not having a closed door significantly increases your survival rate. So that's from the experiential side. If you go to the experimental side, every single study that ULFSRI has done to date has always had an open door and a closed door. And it's, as Bobby alluded to, as Chief alluded to earlier, there's no comparison in how long, how much longer you have behind a closed door versus how much less time you have when that door is open. So every single study that UL has ever done, and they're continuing to do, they've had an open door and a closed door. So you can go look at this empirical data as well.
And just to dovetail with Nick very quickly, we've always, always, always told folks when you're making a high-rise hallway, always have an area of refuge for just that point. Force a door so that if the hallway becomes compromised, you can get behind a closed door yourself. So we're not, Nick and Dustin aren't making stuff up here out of whole cloth. As Nick said, every study, and I've been grateful to have the synopsis sent to me from Steve, because if you have to read through the actual data, your head will explode. But every single one, you look at the temperature, look at the toxicity, it's night and day. It's literally night and day. In most of the burns that we've done, a couple of times, you could have survived the entire burn with that door closed. You could have made it. So it's really, so one other argument that came up, we're talking about this at Limestone, shameless plug for Limestone Fire Protection District number 2 at our volunteer department, was people have said to us, well, if I hear my kids, you're telling me that I can't go down the hallway and get in my kids' room. Now, correct me if I was wrong when I told them. I said, no, if you feel like you have to help the kids, go and then close that door behind you. Would that be a fair statement to make?
Yeah, I think conditions are going to dictate anything. So if you're met with a wall of fire, maybe don't try to walk through the wall of fire. But if conditions allow you, just like when we're searching a building and you get to that door, you finish that one room search for VES, you look back out in that hallway, can you continue that search based on conditions? So like everything, conditions and resources are going to dictate tactics. Same thing when you're home alone with your kids. If I can get across to them, awesome. If I can't, hopefully we've had a discussion with their kids if they're old enough to, if you're on the first floor or maybe if you have, if you're in the basement, that they can open their windows and get out themselves. If they can't, they're on the second floor. Maybe you have some type of escape ladder. If that's not the case, if you can't get across to them, that's where the fire department comes into play. But if you can get to your kids, absolutely get to your kids, because we all know that if there's a fire in our house, as soon as our smoke alarms are going off, instinctually, our first movement is to go to our kids, which is pretty awesome about humans and probably a lot of animals, but we're going to protect our own, right? So if you can protect them, absolutely protect them. And if you can get everybody in one room, that's probably easier than everybody being scattered in 3 or 4 rooms.
Nick, yeah. And there's a lot of what ifs, you know, that we can do with it. So, you know, I kind of like Nick's way he words it, where you tier that, right? If you can get to them and close that door and isolate it. If you can't, hopefully they have their escape route. And then if, you know, even further down the line, if you can't get out and they can't get out, you know, we communicate to the fire department, like, this is our known locations of the victims, and this is where we expect to find, you know, our child or their child's room. So even though, you know, you might not have the ability to get to that other room and isolate it, you know, all these things line up where you can notify the fire department to put them in the best possible scenario to try and locate your loved ones with more information.
PJ, we're going to welcome you back. You want to jump in here?
Yes, I just have two things to add. One is with everything that you talked about close before you doze, I would encourage anybody listening, today live or in the archive, to go to closeyourdoor.org at UL's website, and there's resources there. There's a toolbox. So everything from stickers to coloring books to PSAs and videos that you can share on your department's website, social media stuff is all available to you. And the other piece, which I don't know if you mentioned, I don't think you did, is in Dustin's department at Cobb County, they've done another piece to this close before you doze and matching it with their tactics, is they have their dispatchers communicating to the 911 callers to close their doors if they cannot escape. And then those dispatchers are relaying that information to the companies that are responding. So it's not just a one piece. It's not just close before you doze in the school or in promotional materials. It's not just to the firefighters and the officers during their training and their roundtable discussions to prepare them for that. They're also involving their dispatchers and their dispatchers providing that information to the callers, but also to the responding companies so they can help focus their search techniques and locations a little bit better. So I have to give props to Dustin and Cobb County because it's an entire approach to public education, training and education, and also tactics. That involves probably one of the forgotten pieces of our service almost every day, and that's our dispatchers. So just wanted to throw that plug out there for another piece, but also for Cobb County and what they've been able to successfully do there.
Yeah, so they not only reiterate that information, but they do discuss, hey, if you're able to leave the house, can you close the front door, back door to try and bring it back to that vent limited state? We actually have a audio recording that, of a girl on the phone with 911 throughout the duration until she's rescued. And you can hear it go all the way down from the close before you doze or the close your door to, you know, this is my brother's location in the house and this is who else is with me, even to the point where she can talk to dispatch and tell them where her bedroom is on the house prior to the fire department's arrival. You know, she has no smoke in her room. It's a one-story ranch. She can easily just open her window and walk out. People talk about fight or flight. She had the third one, which was freeze. She was going to sit there and be rescued, and there was nothing else, you know, for it. However, that closed door and the communication with dispatch was able to give us, you know, the location of the victim, how many victims were in there, and dispatch relayed all that information to the first arriving unit before they ever got there.
It's a system approach, and it's a system approach that works. And the last piece of that puzzle is partnering with our law enforcement community. The ISFSI has a very good training program for our law enforcement partners, but they even have a short video. I think it's only like 7 or 8 minutes that if you can forward to your law enforcement community that they can then show during roll call. And it's the law enforcement's response to structure fire. So it covers everything from, you know, parking, not parking in front of hydrants to closing doors to things that they should do, because we know our law enforcement officers are going to arrive before us the majority of the time. They're going to react. They're going to try to make a rescue. They're going to try to make a positive impact on that incident. So it's up to us to make sure that they know how to do that safely and appropriately and not put themselves, their lives in jeopardy, the civilians' lives in jeopardy, or ours. So it's an entire system approach to public fire education, tactics, communications, as well as our law enforcement. So I'm sure you covered everything else that I wanted to today, and I appreciate, I can't wait to go back and listen to the conversation, and I apologize that I had to step away for a few, but thanks for having this discussion today, and I hope that everybody out there can find some benefit and maybe could bring pieces or parts of this to their agencies.
Bobby, we're at the 2 o'clock hour, so let's go around the horn and everybody have last words, and we'll start with you.
Well, one of the other things that came up when we were talking about this, and remember my generation, I was reminded that back in the day in the enlisted barracks and in the college dormitories, we knew that if you placed a towel in a strategic location by the under the door, you could prevent smoke from going out of a room as well. Now, I can neither confirm nor deny that I practiced that, but I had a lot of towels. So this is a great move. And I applaud Dustin again, just a shameless plug, you know, sign up for his class. He's a great instructor. Sign up for Nick's. He's a wonderful asset. If you don't know these guys, you know, get to know these guys. They're just amazing people to know as people, but as fire service instructors, they're second to nobody. And this is a great program. And it's tough. I mean, I'll just be honest with you. It's tough. I was trying to sell it to my wife and she's a hard sell, you know, so you got, they'll be generational stuff, you know, so be kind with the folks out there that, you know, that struggle with it. And, at least get them to understand if they do smell smoke and they're at, close the door. You know what I mean? Don't, and then call 911 and get out via a safe, exit that you've rehearsed. So, and in full disclosure too, to Nick's point, and or maybe it was Dustin's point rather, about the young lady who wouldn't open a window. One of the things we have to remember is that when people are under that, those kinds of pressures, those fine motor skills, like even unlocking a window and raising a window up, can be extremely difficult. And so, for us, a fire is not an unusual event, but to a civilian, it's usually a once in a lifetime experience. And so their ability to process really simple things is just not there. So I totally understand what Dustin was saying, and that's not unusual. You know, when you hear people, I can't do it, and they mean it, and they're right. So a great point to raise. And I just want to say thank you to both you guys. And thank you to everybody earlier for indulging us. These gentlemen were not involved in the earlier discussion, in case their jobs want to know. That discussion was strictly between Frank and I. So full disclosure, we knew they did not want to be involved, so that they had no culpability at all in that. So if anyone has any questions about whether or not they participated, they did not. So those, and the opinions expressed in there are mine and Frank's, period. So everyone else is completely indemnified.
Well said. Dustin?
Yeah, I just want to reiterate the importance of the program, particularly for when you're looking at not the field and the rank and file. If we're wanting to make rescues and to make successful rescues, making sure that the Close Before You Doze campaign that is properly rolled out is only going to help us increase those numbers. We can look that fires have gone down over the last 10 years. However, the fatalities remain the same. So although we're doing a pretty good job of notifying people, we want them to know that Close Before You Doze gives us the best probability to help them. And as well from the field level, utilizing some of the research and the numbers, including the ability to bring victims into rooms and isolate them rather than back through the building, is something that we can use as well.
It's still all about the victims. Very well said, Nick. And Nick, if you could tell us, if a fire department has a rescue, how do they get in touch with you to collect that data?
Yeah, absolutely. So if you just go to firefighterrescuesurvey.com, after you make a rescue, fill out a quick survey. It takes 5 to 10 minutes if you have a couple pieces of information in front of you. Super easy to do, doesn't take long. And then that information, we're completely transparent on it. Everybody has access to that. So none of this is behind any walls. No one's hiding any of this information. I also want to say thank you to Frank, PJ, and Chief Halton. Thank you for letting us come on here. Go to closeyourdoor.org to check out UL's site. And then don't take any of our words for this. Go to the data, look at the data at Firefighter Rescue Survey. And then also go to the empirical data from ULFSRI and see the difference between when there's an open door and a closed door between those two areas, and do the research yourself and see what conclusions you come to.
Nick, before I pass this to PJ, when was the last time you wrote an article about the data that you've been collecting for fire engineering?
For fire engineering? Yes. I think it was in February of 2020. I think there was an article called The First 1000. So February 2020, I believe, is when, so just before COVID hit.
Can you send us that link? Because we'll have Peter attach it to this show. And PJ, if you could send us the UL links to Peter so he can attach the workshops and the toolbox to this show as well.
Perfect. There's one more resource. There was Elkhart, Indiana, had a rescue a couple months ago from a little girl who was taught the importance of closing before you doze. And then she had a fire at her house, unfortunately, and she remembered everything that she was taught. So when the brothers and sisters go out teaching this stuff in the schools and in the old folks home or wherever they go teaching this stuff, have fun doing it. When you have fun doing it and you believe in the message, I promise you people are going to hear that message and remember that message more so. So don't just go through the motions. Actually be out there. You're doing a good thing. It's pretty fun. You get to meet some teachers, meet some kids. It's a good time. So have fun while you do it.
Very well said. PJ.
Great points. Sorry I missed it. But thanks for taking the time out of your schedules. Dustin, I know especially for you, you got a big game coming. I'm disappointed in the New York Yankees aren't playing, but I have to support the Atlanta Braves right now. So,
as does the rest of America, go Braves.
There's a very small dot on the map, United States, of supporting Houston. I'm one of the your newfound Atlanta fans. So, go Atlanta. But thanks for today. For those of you watching, I would definitely echo Chief Halton's words. All three of these guys are teaching FDIC 2022. It's not too early to register. It's not too early to start looking at housing. It's not too early to start preparing. Some of the best instructors are kind of sitting and standing in front of you today. Take advantage, get to FDIC 2022 and get in these classes. You will not be disappointed. Go back, look at the research, look at the data, make sure that is going into your training and education. And also the same messages are being delivered for your public fire education. Talk to your dispatchers, talk to your law enforcement community, and put a whole system in place to best protect your community. That's all I got. And, thanks again for today, Frank. I appreciate it.
Hey, you put together a great show. Thanks to Bobby Hall and Dustin, Nick, and PJ. Everybody have a good day. Be safe and take care of each other. And Peter, you can take us off and have a great day.
Take care, everybody. Thank you.